Creative City: How to Strengthen Human Connections in the Digital Era. Hi, my name is Marcin Wojciech-Żebrowski and welcome to the newest episode of Urbcast, my podcast about urbanism, architecture, cities and many more. And today I have enormous pleasure to fulfill one of my dreams, actually, because today the guest of the podcast is Charles Landry, who is an international authority on the use of imagination and creativity in urban change. Over 30 years ago, Charles wrote the book Creative City and coined the term Creative City, which influences the way we look at the cities nowadays and how can the creativity shape the way that cities look today. We will discuss during our conversation the creative city concept evolution from the times that it was founded and from the book written in 1994 to 2023, today, having many different challenges in cities. So we have to balance the creativity, diversity, innovation with gentrification and huge disproportions in our cities. Another interesting topic is the future of creative cities in the midst of the new digital era, AI, metaverse, but also climate change. And then we also conclude with the art of human connection and gathering. Although we are in a way more and more connected nowadays, we are striving for the physical connection as never before. This episode was brought to you and was recorded during Urban Future Conference that took place this year, 2023, in Stuttgart. It was a great place to meet people like Charles and get extremely inspired. And this is exactly what happened. So I hope that you will enjoy the result of our conversation about the creative city. Welcome to the episode with Charles Landry. I will start with saying, Charles, I'm so flattered. I'm so honored. Thank you for coming to Urbcast.
Well, it's my pleasure being here and having a conversation with you, Marcin.
It's an especially interesting circumstance because we met already. It was 2-3 weeks ago in beautiful Copenhagen. And I remember just approaching you after your lecture, after your speech. And I also remember you just giving me some of your books. I felt like inspired. So thanks for coming here and I hope sharing some interesting thoughts about the creative city. And I assume many of the listeners know what a creative city is already, but to those of you who might not know, could you just say something more about it, especially in terms of inspiration to dive into this topic of what is the creative city?
Well, the idea of the creative city came to me not in a simple, complete thing. I was always interested in the way people may or may not be able to express their potential. And I noticed that people really were not doing that. So I thought about, they're quite interesting, but they can't express themselves. And then I thought about organizations. Ooh, some of those, perhaps they also need creativity. Perhaps they are already creative. But then I felt perhaps it's the city that's most interesting for me, because then you've got individuals and organizations and the complexity of a city and all the cultures and the differences. How could you bring all of that together? And essentially, how could people fulfill and express themselves well? So if you summarized what is a creative city from my perspective, a creative city is a place where people, organizations, clearly lots of organizations, provide the conditions for people and organizations to think, plan, and act with imagination in solving problems and creating opportunities. That's the simple definition. So what it's really is about a place that is more open than closed. It's a place that's more willing to say, let's try this out, let's experiment, and so on. And it doesn't mean that we're experimenting every minute of the day. Also, when I initially thought about it in, I don't know, a long time ago, I've forgotten when it was, 1988 or something, there was a bit of a focus on culture in a bigger sense, the widest sense of culture, and in a narrower sense, the arts. And that was particularly in response to cities having to rethink, particularly in Europe, what their economic basis would be as things moved to Asia and so on. So they had to ask themselves, what are my resources? And when you ask that question, let's say Glasgow, a former industrial city, it sort of goes deeply into its culture. Some of it's industrial, but a lot of it is about its character, its distinctiveness, its qualities, and so on. And how that then often is expressed is through artistic expression. So initially, there was quite a bit of a focus on focusing or looking at the arts as one trigger, as one dynamic thing that was pushing this forward. Over time, I widened, from my perspective at least, the idea, you know, social innovation, business innovation, academic new ideas, etc., and most recently, bureaucratic innovation. So that gives you a bit of a trajectory.
Since we live in a globalized world right now, how much of this creation and this creative spirit of a city can be exported from different places, and how much of it is this genius loci, this kind of spirit of a place? Does it depend on a city?
I think in principle, every place can be more imaginative, more inventive, more creative than it already is. Every place in the world has these elements because it needs it to survive, to move forward, to solve the problems it has. Its expression often is likely to be different in, let's say, Ghana or in Taiwan or in, I don't know, Abu Dhabi and so on. But there are some core characteristics which I think are the same. And I mentioned one already. It's being more open than closed. It's willing to assess. It's willing to listen. It's willing to say, I will try something out. So those are the qualities that are the same. And it's willing to try to give people agency. One way of saying it is letting them be empowered or something to express themselves. So those qualities, I think, are true through time and also through geographic space.
The term, the creative city that you coined in the 90s, I think that the first edition of the book I found out in the internet took place in 94, which is a bit time ago. I was born in 94, actually, so it was a bit time ago. And now we are sitting here and discussing that many, many years after 2023. When I was preparing for this discussion with you, Charles, I was thinking about the change that happened in the creative city as a notion, as a concept. What is the change, in your opinion, between this concept in the 90s and right now?
Well, that's a good question. And also, we have to credit someone I've always credited, and he used to be forgotten, but he isn't forgotten anymore, who used to be the chief planner of Victoria in Melbourne, and he was called David Jenkin. And he wrote perhaps the first article which said something like the creative city is XYZ. And this was in parallel, this was in 88, 89, when we were equally looking at this word, searching for this word. What we then did is sort of turn it into an urban policy, i.e. saying this is what you could do. And particularly initially, a lot of it was about the creative economy and all of that stuff. And now it's much wider. So you would say that a focus of the creative city for the first 15, 20 years was, let's say, variations of the arts and the wider arts, the industrial versions of the art, let's call it the creative cultural economy for the moment. So it's that broad spectrum. Then other areas came in that I've already mentioned, social innovation and so on. But the focus initially was very much about rehabilitation in cities because, as you well know, all over the world there were old industrial buildings that needed repurposing. And it's very ironic that those buildings that had horrible working conditions where people were probably a bit like slaves hammering metal and steel are then taken as the places for the hip and the cool. But let's put that by side. The reason why I believe people find these places inspiring is because of their structures that you, as someone who is in them, can help make, create, and develop the place as it's moving on. So you see the patina of ages in them. So you could say one of the main focuses at the beginning was physical rehabilitation, often using arts as a trigger. A second thing that then was part of it, and this then is more the organizations that might inhabit these buildings, which may have been not only semi-commercial companies, but also socially oriented arts companies who were talking about, I don't know, community participation or belonging and things of that nature. So you've got here two things going on. The physical thing, but also this thing about enabling people to have agency and, in a sense, acknowledging that these are people, they're a somebody, they're not a nobody, and bringing people in to ideally, ultimately, decision making. The focus, of course, has to change through time because creativity needs a purpose. Whilst I believe that we as a general attitude should allow people to be imaginative, that's a sort of generalized thing, then you have to say, well, and what am I specifically going to do with that? So over time, and clearly we have to say, well, what today are the big issues that really matter? You know, we know what they are: inequality, diversity, I mean, absorbing diversity, climate change, all of those things that we know about. So then you can ask of creativity a series of things. You could go back to the sort of traditional thing that was, what is the role of the arts and creativity? And you could say, how can arts projects or cultural projects in a bigger sense contribute to us having and changing our behavior vis-a-vis climate change? How can arts help us deal with unemployment and inequality? So you can do always the link between that traditional idea and the new urgencies that we all have. Or you could simply look at, if we look at, let's say, the climate emergency and say, Christ, what's our problem? What can we do? Can we develop new finance mechanisms to make sure that companies are encouraged to actually behave in a completely different way? Can we think of new services and products that are not only technology, by the way, that are in effect creative, but don't have anything to do necessarily with art or anything else? So the spectrum, we're back to this point, that this is an all-purpose creativity, in the way I'm looking at it, is an all-purpose quality that it would be good to have. And within that, I think when we're talking about, you know, what's happening in a place and you're looking at the environment, it's saying, okay, how do you create an ecosystem of creativity? Let's call it that. But for me, what I only realized much later was that we first need to create an environment where people can be curious. If you've got a place where 25% of the population, young people, are unemployed, don't say to them, oh, just be creative. It's about time you were bloody creative or something. Be entrepreneurial, set up a business. The first thing is to help them be and encourage them to be curious. If they're curious, they might be imaginative. If they're imaginative, they might be creative and might invent something and then be create an innovation. So I've really shifted a bit, or not shifted, but just feel that that question of creating an environment of curiosity, which then begins to deal with so many, particularly younger people who feel disadvantaged, forgotten, and so on, it's that. And there we come back again sometimes to the arts, because younger people, and I'm speaking a bit in cliches, you know, tend to like music, might want to be into music. So obviously things to do with music might be the entry point for curiosity that may lead them to be imaginative and do all sorts of interesting things. They may not end up being a musician because only 1 in 100 or 1,000 becomes a famous star. But they will have learned techniques, confidence through the expression, or if they're being a DJ, how to, you know, deal with technology and so on, which is more broadly useful. So in short and in summary, creativity should be about The focus should be about the big issues that really matter.
You emphasized the role of arts, and you also said that the art was the trigger for the rehabilitation. I'm wondering, if we discuss arts, how much of the grassroots arts do you mean here, and how much of the curated arts do you mean? Because in the latter, there's also a big in money investment that has to follow, right?
Yeah, these are all the big tensions. I mean, everything we're saying, you know, what I'm talking about might sound very smooth and straightforward and all of that. In each of these moments we're discussing, there are dilemmas, and we'll come to that in a moment. The first dilemma is, okay, there are all these empty buildings. Lots of artists might say, I can do something with it. And then the property development community says, let's tear the building down and put expensive apartments in here. And the population that used to live here, they can move somewhere else. That's a classic dilemma, namely the gentrification dilemma. So the creative point there is, can you create regulations and incentives that it doesn't always end up like that? In terms of grassroots art or art from below or art from people who are unconventional, here the problem is clearly because people recognize that artists can do something to an atmosphere that is sort of can be provocative, edgy, but also interesting and so on. What you typically get, and we know that, is, you know, you rehabilitate an area, then the artists move in, they make it safe, the cafe moves in, the next person feels, oh, well, that's quite interesting. And in the end, you have the accountant who is not really creative in that particular sense, moving in, and then the whole atmosphere dies. And this is where, again, a shift in creativity is necessary, is this balancing act. Now, places never stay completely the same forever, clearly, and they evolve, and that's fine. But it is important, I think, to try to work with these dilemmas. You know, if you take any city, Copenhagen, you know, suddenly is exploding. If you take Berlin, it's exploding. And these dilemmas are absolutely visible on the streets. And so that's where you need another form of creativity, which is to do with regulations, which is to do with finance, which is to do with incentives, which is very different from the things from before. But you have to, in my view, the market mechanism on its own will not necessarily enable, as you asked the question about these grassroots arts, won't necessarily suddenly make them flourish. You've got to sort of create perhaps some protected spaces. You might have to do a bit of funding. But in the end, if you make a calculation and ask yourself, what's the impact of that? The impact is more likely to be positive than negative. And of course, it's not an easy, simple quantity. You know, I put 5 units of helping grassroots art and I got 10 units out. It's not as simple as that. But in general, it's more likely to be positive than negative.
Do you think that the benefits of the creative character of a city can be evenly spread between the citizens? Because I can think of a space that becomes creative, that becomes this hotspot within a city or within a district. And then the side effect of that might be the before mentioned gentrification. Like, while studying cities worldwide throughout many years of you actually touring with the agenda and the world with introducing the concept of creative city, have you met some interesting examples of cities that would try to work with more even access to the benefits of the creation?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing to say is when this agenda began to be developed from the late 80s onwards, that was not the first thing that one thought of, because there was just such decline everywhere. So you were just thinking, let's focus on all of this. And we didn't collectively so much think about that which became gentrification. And gentrification to some extent is also good, you know, because people in poor areas also want a better environment. They also want to hang out in a cafe, just relax, look at the world go by, walk their dog, all of these things. They want better quality public space. So it's always a question of the threshold. So my main point about containing this is the market on its own cannot do that. The market will inevitably create these divisions, will inevitably, if the places and the artists, you know, there was graffiti in the olden days, artists, the vanguard of gentrification. You have to then shift creativity towards these things and do some things that the property development community might not like, but actually in the long term they will like it, because the place, I think, will be a more difficult word, authentic, but what I mean, a place that has some combination of different people. I think the main thing from city makers' point of view and decision makers' point of view is always to be alert to intervene. So often in terms of bureaucracies, we want to have a policy that goes sort of forever. But it may be that you have a policy for 18 months, you allow this, and then you say you can't do that because you're trying to curate, in a sense, an environment that feels more balanced. Now, of course, some cities don't mind that are the very rich areas and very poor areas. You know, I think in the end, that causes issues and problems. Well, I think this leads to a question I think we both want to talk about, which is really that question of diversity, mixed populations, yes, and so on. But over to you.
Yeah, I would think of the challenges first, because if we talk about the diversity and creativity in the cities, I can't stop thinking of the challenges that we are facing at the same time. And I was just thinking of, in face of those increasing challenges and globalization as well, and a huge blend of international people and cultures being mixed in many various cities, how the cities can preserve this unique local identity, something they've built their identity on, and this distinctiveness, but at the same time also embracing the diversity.
Yes. Again, this is another one of our central dilemmas, which partly in the British case led to Brexit, because people say, oh, these foreigners are coming in and you're, you know, spoiling where I live. But when we look at places closely, practically every city, small or large, actually through time always had changes going on. It was never, the distinctiveness was never fixed. It changed and so on. The difference between then and now is the speed which that change and that absorption effect is happening, particularly with the war in Ukraine and, you know, when several million people or Syria move out of those countries. So the question is the mass and the speed. If things happen at a slower pace, what you then can say, and we did a massive five-year project, which has been taken up by the Council of Europe, where there's a big network called the Intercultural City, which we explored all of these things through time. And you can see precisely that point, that all places are really changing if you take the long view. And one of the things we analysed is, what is the ways in which we both, all of us, can get on better? And there are various things that are there, and I'm saying some trivial things. But one of the most important things is, if you take kids to school and they share school and they come from completely different backgrounds, they're more likely to be, you know, sympathetic and like each other and love each other later because they've had that joint experience. The other thing is meeting at things like the doctors. When you've both got a toothache, if you're black or white, the most important thing is, I've got a toothache, rather than you're black and I'm white or something like that, or I'm a guy and you're a woman and so on. So you have to create contexts of gathering and dialogue, which is why public space is so important. Now, I'm not going to say that it's always easy, because we know the sort of typical urbanite, the sort of slightly, you know, I've traveled a lot type person will, of course, enjoy the diversity of different cultures more easily than the person who's perhaps come from a small place and there hasn't been so much change. And I think one has to be sympathetic to that. That doesn't mean they are right if they to say, kick them all out. But nevertheless, one needs to understand their reasoning. And this is why cross-cultural dialogue and all of these contexts of meeting the other is really important. And sometimes one has to be quite structured about it. And people might say, well, that's a bit unnatural that you force a situation where you as a Pole talk to me as a British person or whatever I am. Do you see what I mean? Or you as a Nigerian talk to me as a, I don't know what, a Norwegian, etc., etc. Because I think we can get this discussion, particularly amongst the more liberal groupings, that what's their bloody problem, you know, just accept there are all these differences. And I think one needs to work at the differences and understand there is conflict. And a friend of mine, Tommy Lightio, he focuses very much on convivencia, which is not conviviality, is obviously living together, you know, we mix and so con vivere. But convivencia is more about acknowledging that not everything is so harmonious, rather like in a family, that you have to sort of work out how to get on. So you have to some extent, create safe environments. And most cities really need to work hard on that. And it's not all trying to be, oh, holier than thou, I'm so nice and all of that. It's just sort of saying, this is the world we have here. This is the diversity. But also, you know, one of the things one wants, this is why we called our work the Intercultural City, I want to meet an Albanian. I want to meet someone from Malaysia. I want to be intercultural rather than multicultural. Most cities define themselves as multicultural, i.e. the Somalis stay with the Somalis, the Afghanis with the Afghanis, etc. Completely understood why that's the case. You speak the same language, all of these cultural things. But what is really important, I think, and that's also a question to the Afghani, the Somali, and all of that, please come out as well. All of us have to make an effort, whatever our religion, background.
I think it's easier said than done. And I will just use this example of what happened in Poland, like in the 2015, when a huge refugee crisis influenced the whole of Europe, people fleeing from Syria and other places. There was this huge debate in Poland, and the political kind of decision was that we wouldn't like to open our borders to people fleeing the war. But when the war in Ukraine happened, we did not think a single moment. And of course, we helped the Ukraine and we found a place for a couple of million of them. So I think that what's embedded in us as human beings, as tribal animals, is also this fear of unknown. I'm wondering if you could give an example of this successful integration, of this successful cultural exchange, successful diversity.
Yeah, I mean, you're completely right about that. You know, I suppose because Syrians look Arabic or whatever, you look slightly different, whereas Ukrainians and Poles have a, you know, 300-year history together, good, bad, whatever. Anyway, you've been together for a very long time. I mean, in some sense, you could say there's a racist element there, you know, we're okay with them, but not with them. Clearly, one of the questions is simply the amount. There are too many people all the time. There are probably too many people in the world. All of these problems get exacerbated when the number is bigger than before. You know, there are some historic examples that people talk about. You know, Cordoba, when Maimonides, the Jewish philosopher, lived. And there's a street called Maimonides Street, and then the mosque was then turned into a Catholic thing. But they didn't, it was so beautiful that they kept both inside. But for a short period, there was Judaism, Muslims, Islam, and Catholicism being together. I think if you look at Europe or other countries, I mean, Malaysia, even though it's dominated, obviously, by Islam. Penang, for example, the island of Penang, there is a very interesting mix of Chinese, Malaysians, and Indians, just as an example. There is a bit of a separation, but they get on with each other. So there, I don't think, you know, what you're really saying is, where is there a good melting pot? Normally, in terms of intercultural relations, people highlight Canada as a good country at a national level that is somehow been able to incorporate incomers. They've, of course, recently had the problem with the indigenous people, the Inuit and stuff like that, all of these horrible things that were happening. But in general, Canada as a country is often seen as a model. And various other countries that were seen as models, you know, for example, the Netherlands and stuff like that, there's been, again, you know, a far right response to these things. And I think a lot of this is to do with and again, it sounds like a cliche, the speed of change, that you're not in control of change, the new media, the new technologies, that you just feel, I've got to go back to that that I know, Brexit being a primary example of that. So if you really say good integration, I think probably Portugal is relatively good, and this is all relatively speaking here, is relatively good. You know, in Brazil, of course, there's racism in Brazil, but there was quite a lot of intermarriage. The key thing, you know, I'll give you another example from our Intercultural Cities project. One of the most effective ways of people meeting each other was in the military. So there was more proportionally intermarriages between black and white or Chinese and white in the military, because one thing's clear, my focus is the military, not where, do you see what I mean? We're back to, I'm at the dentist together. So unfortunately, I don't think I can say a particular country, but we can, and we all know the countries which are particularly bad as distinct from particularly good. So I know that's not quite satisfactory, but Switzerland, perhaps, but then again, is it okay with people who are brown people? You know, I don't know.
When I was asking this question, I know that it's a hard one to answer. It's a very broad one as well. And maybe I will provide you with even more difficult one, because why not? I want to pick your brain as well. I was wondering, how do you foresee the future evolution of the concept of the creative city? Because we've already traveled back in time a bit during this conversation. But as we discussed, there's a lot of new emerging trends and challenges as well. Climate being, I think, the most burning issue now. But also the other emerging trends like the role of AI, the role of metaverse. Have you had any thoughts so far? What implications can it have on the concept of creative city?
All of them have consequences. So in each case, take AI, metaverse, climate change. Climate change we partly discussed. What's the creative approach to climate change, leaving aside of accepting the urgency and acting, but what is the project you're going to do? So that's perhaps where the creativity comes in finding the solution or allowing movements of change to occur. And so we come back to the bureaucracy, which we haven't discussed much, the enabling that to become possible. In terms of AI, I'm really focused on, when I think of the creative city, about this issue of agency. Do I have agency over my own life? Am I a somebody, as a friend of mine said, rather than a nobody? Am I just an object in space? If you take that human sovereignty as a key anchor point and a starting point, and there are other principles which gets us into the realm of ethics, then you want those ethics to be taken up by politics, which then becomes policy. Then in terms of AI, need policies. And apparently there are only about 6 or 7 cities that actually have an AI policy. It's always the same cities, Barcelona, Amsterdam, Helsinki, etc., who have these coherent policies. And again, they're anchored in you having control over your life. That's the same with those cities in terms of sensors in the environment. You know, am I being watched? Amsterdam, you can, I believe, identify where those are, where you are being watched. So that's all about sovereignty. Now that, of course, is a European thing. If you're in China, what we're discussing is a different story. So, okay, we're being, in this case, perhaps a bit Eurocentric. But I think those values that embodies that, I think are good values. Now, there's no doubt that with various mechanical processes, AI, if we just talk about the way the city works, which involves us in discussions about the public administration, that it can actually save work. The classic argument is it will then leave you time to do the more interesting, creative, or whatever work. But again, it has to be guided and led. That's the key thing. If we talk about AI, it clearly has potential. In terms of the metaverse, you know, I've thought a bit about the metaverse, you know, here and there, had virtual reality glasses on and try all these things out. So far, they don't satisfy me so much. And I'm sure the business world, you know, Meta itself, ex-Facebook, will try to convince me, and the new Google things that are coming out will convince me that I need these things. But what I found very interesting is the pandemic was horrible for many people. Many people died, etc., etc., etc. Single parents, third floor, looking after kids, horrible, horrible, horrible. But for some people, it was actually a wonderful period, I'm exaggerating perhaps, where you actually could calm down, slow down. But one of the flip sides of it, back to our metaverse, because that was really about the digital turn. It said so many innovations happened in that period. But then when we met again, it was just a completely different experience. So we could have done this online, but I think it is a different experience that we are just physically in this same space. There's something happening with pheromones and whatever, the physicality of us being there. And I don't think that will go. Now, of course, there will be more virtual experiences. If we took tourism as an example, over tourism, so you might actually say, Christ, the last time, I'm not saying we should all say this, I'd prefer to look at it online, yeah? And you could say that about the Mona Lisa. You know, you can think of all these experiences which are too much. So I think in that realm, there'll be a hell of a lot of this happening because you'd prefer just to stay at home. So it's a difficult one. And I think that's also an age-specific one. You know, I'm relatively old, and the perception of someone who's 25 might be completely different. Now, they may be right, but it doesn't mean they are right to think it's all fantastic. Because I'm always asking myself, what is really true through time? What is true, whether it's today, 50 years ago, 100 years ago? And I'm not trying to be a nostalgic traditionalist or whatever, but one of the things that I think is true through time is gathering and meeting and socializing. And I love the Spanish word sobremesa, which is that you have lunch, it extends, you know most of the people, that may be your family, someone comes in, you don't really know, someone knows them, oh, hi, and then it extends through the evening. You know, that is true through time. And it's those things we really need to remember. What are those things through time? And I'm obviously talking about connection.
The art of connection, the art of gathering. It's very inspiring, Charles. Thank you for that. I could also just bring the expression of the sharing is caring. It also has some truth in that. Speaking of sharing, to summarize this discussion, would you like to share potentially a book or maybe some other source around the topic?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm reading at the moment, and I try to read as few technical books as possible. I was reading a book by a guy who's Blondie, you know, the group Blondie, yes. Their guitarist, Gary Lachman, became a philosopher and an author on consciousness. And he's written a fantastic series of books. They're all scrambling in my mind, but just look up Gary Lachman, L-A-C-H-M-A-N, and you'll find all his books, which are about the history of consciousness, different ways of looking at things. And what he's really saying is the very narrow way that we look at things, very linear, like the linear arrow of time, often means we don't see the totality of things. We're not really experiencing things properly. Because we're not experiencing things properly, because we're not letting the whole of our mindscape see what we're seeing, we're reducing ourselves, yeah? We feel less. And I think just him as an example, and I love the fact that he was a pop singer and quite well known and then became a philosopher, is quite an interesting transition. So just to be very practical, it's like when you look out of the window, not saying, oh, this is beautiful or this is ugly or whatever, and labeling things, you just look at things. This is, happens to be a cityscape or a naturescape, and just let it sort of be there and let that affect you. Now, that may seem vague, but one of the big issues is really in this world where we want to quantify everything, when so many things are also quite intangible and vague. But sometimes the vague is interesting and important. And as I've said occasionally, is this is soft stuff. The soft is the hard. The soft understanding, the soft stuff is often very hard. You know, the material facts, yeah, there are 50 buildings, the road is long, the steps are short, the whatever is all easy. But the soft, the subtle stuff that is really the fabric of life, the soul of a place, and that's when you speak to people, that's why it's so important to physically speak to them and touch them. You know, I did a short book called The Sensory Landscape of Cities, where I went through every sense, touching, feeling, smelling. When you do that, then you get this visceral experience. And I think why that's important is then to understand why we need to act, let's say, vis-a-vis climate change. When you really feel it, when you feel the tree dying because the emissions are so dreadful, you know, when you feel that, when you feel the tree. You get what I'm saying. So that's all a bit vague, but I think vaguely important.
Charles, thank you very much for this. I think it is such a pleasure to listen to you. And I do share the same feeling that meeting physically is so important. And even though we could also connect and record this discussion online, no problem with that. I mean, definitely the technology is there to have a very good quality conversation. I so appreciate that we could have shared this time here in this room in the Urban Future Conference. Thank you for enriching Urbcast program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the newest episode. And I hope that you enjoyed listening to Charles Landry, who is without any doubt one of the most influential urban thinkers. This time we discussed the creative city concept and its evolution, and I hope that if you haven't read or if you haven't been familiar with Charles' book and other work before, please catch up, because this is very, very important chapter of the history of urbanism, I would say. This episode was done together in a collaboration with Urban Future Conference. I sent warm greetings to the whole team of Urban Future. It was great to meet earlier this year in Stuttgart, and I can't wait for the next edition, 2024, in Rotterdam. That was the last episode in our collaboration, and I'm happy that I was able to be the media partner of the conference. Thank you one more time, and talk to you soon.